I loved that time. It was a fantastic time for filmmakers, for audience, for actors, because you just had your friends and you could do it. And right. The directors weren't burdened with a little list of names of who they had to cast, and you know, and you know, if you didn't have the permit, you just found a way to shoot at night, or right. You just didn't stop. And it was a great time. It was so creative. That's what it was, and collaborative. And those are the things that I love.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Welcome to FilmWax Radio, episode number 199. Yes, it is episode number 199. We're close to the milestone 200th. You'll just have to wait a few more days to find out who that guest is. I gave a clue last week about it. And by the way, if you don't know, my name is Adam Shartoff. I'm hosting FilmWax Radio, the indie film podcast. Like I say, last week I left a clue about my guest on episode 200, and the clue was that this person was a New York-based filmmaker and a legend. I think I said that, but that's the case. Okay, another clue. All right, let's see. This person has won an Academy Award. How's that? Okay, that's good enough. You can, if you think you know who it is, send me an email at adam@filmwax.com, and I will read your email on the air next week. I'll in the introduction or in the, you know, wind down at the end, and I will also mail you a free DVD of some sort. I have a bunch sitting around here, and I'll make sure I get you that. So write in adam@filmwax.com. You can also, by the way, always leave a message at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. But we'll be going into more details about the various ways of keeping in touch with me and the show. So that's happening. I also wanted to say at the top of the show, before we get into the meat of the actual episode, that I will be doing my first live podcast. I mean, this seems to be something that a number of podcasts do. It makes sense. The show lends itself. The details are that on April the 12th, we will be doing our first live podcast of FilmWax Radio at Videology, which is located at 308 Bedford Avenue. That's 308 Bedford Avenue. I think it's at South First. In Williamsburg. Again, April 12th, 5 o'clock p.m. at Videology. We'll be doing that. This much I can report. We'll have the folks from Newton from Rooftop Films there. They're going to announce their 2014 slate, very excited about that. And then we're going to bring on a few guests, and I will drop one guest right now, Onur Tükel, who is an old friend of this podcast of mine. He is a director. He has a brand new film called Summer of Blood, which is going to have its world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival in just a few weeks. So we're going to have Onur on. We're going to have a couple more. I'll announce another guest very soon. But I think we'll probably have at least three guests. But we'll have Dan Nuxalon from Rooftop Films to talk about the new season of Rooftop Films. And then we'll go into a few other guests. And if you can come down there, please do. And, you know, have some drinks. Most likely, I think we're arranging an alcohol sponsor so we can give away some free drinks. And I'm very excited. You know, things are growing for the podcast, and I'm very, very glad that that's the case, and that maybe some people are listening in and responding positively to it. So thank you for that. So I'm going to now let's go into this show, because it is so jam-packed. I don't want to take up any more time, except just to say that rather than go into great length about what's all the stuff that's coming up, and there's so much of it, I'm just going to go right into the first segment momentarily, and it is with the exceptionally talented and attractive actress Lily Taylor. You may, of course, recall Lily Taylor. Oh, my goodness, she's been around for a long time now. She has been making films for over 25 years. but maybe the first thing that put her sort of on the map was Mystic Pizza. But she was in Say Anything. I have to go back and look at that. I don't remember her in that, but apparently she was in it. And then she was also had a small role in Born on the 4th of July. And then, you know, started hitting it with a number of films, including she was in Shortcuts, the Altman film. She was in Prêt-à-Porter, another Altman film. She did, what else? She was in I Shot Andy. Okay, so you skip ahead a little bit, and of course, where she played Valerie Jean Solanas in I Shot Andy Warhol. That might have been kind of the role that transitioned her into lead role acting. And she's done so many films since then, as well as a lot of TV. And I just think she's the greatest thing. One of my favorite films, and I mentioned this during the show, is called Julie Johnson. It is on Netflix, and if you can check it out, please do. No surprise she was had a small role in. No surprise she was in Being Flynn, because she's actually married to Nick Flynn, who wrote it, the book, and whose life that film is based on. And she was in the recent The Conjuring, which was a terrifying film. If you haven't seen that yet, you should rent it. And currently in a TV series called Almost Human, I have not checked out. And now she's in a new film called The Cold Lands. And it is opening here in New York on this Friday, March 14th. So, and then we'll be back afterwards with segment two. We're going to talk to programmers Yuta Jensen and Dennis Lim. Yuta is from MoMA. Yuta is from MoMA, and Dennis is from the Film Society Lincoln Center. And, of course, the two organizations are about to launch the 43rd season of New Directors, New Films. So they're going to come on and talk about that. The next couple of segments after that are with filmmakers Eliza Hittman, whose film It Felt Like Love is about to come out theatrically, and, of course, Matt Wolff, who has a stunning documentary called Teenage, which is also about to come out. So it's a very jam-packed episode. Let's get going with my conversation with actress Lily Taylor.
Atticus!
Hey, wash your hair while you're in there, okay?
Mom.
Are you perfect?
Maybe I am.
I mean, if they keep you for observation, he could come and stay with us until you're released.
We don't need any help, really.
If they think you need him, then they think they can tell you what to do. So the best thing is to not need him.
Self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient.
Great. This is a podcast on independent film, primarily. Mm-hmm. Do you know Rooftop Films? Familiar with Rooftop Films?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Well, you have to come this summer.
I do.
Oh, great. Well, this is with Rooftop Films.
Oh, great.
I mean, it's on their website, and I partner with them. And my name is Adam. Hi.
Hi.
It's nice to meet you, Lily.
Yeah.
If I can call you Lily.
Yes.
Okay, great. I was saying to Lauren on the way in that it's kind of funny. I just this morning got an email from the publicist, Emma, about the fact that you're in a...
Could you close the door? Thanks. Okay, cool.
Thanks for the water. That you're in a new play at the Public Theater, going to be directed by Steven Soderbergh, right? Who, thank God, got out of the film game because he had no sort of sense of what he was doing in that sphere,
yeah.
Right? Well, that much we know.
Yeah.
But anyway, long story short, in 1988, I was a member of the Public Theater...
Uh-huh.
I was 11. No, I'm kidding. But and I saw you in a play there, and it was the first time I was introduced to you in any way. And I said, "Who is that
really?
Girl?"
Wow.
I did. I was like really swept up in your
performance. Wow.
I really liked. I thought you were so uniquely, appealing and attractive. But I it wasn't surprised that I started seeing you.
Huh.
After that, and you were on my radar, but I guess you hadn't done a lot of film up to that point, right?
I had done a couple of things. Three, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but that,
Mystic
but that
pizza or something.
Exactly. Like say okay. Anything Mystic, and then I had a little bit of change to come to New York, and I just knew you needed a little bit of cash to make the city work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then coming to do a play, it was perfect. And Richard Foreman, it was Richard Foreman. That
yes,
was 88.
I went back and I did a little bit of the research. And what's his name? Michael Sisto or what was the
Rocco Sisto and Will Patton.
And Will Patton was in
that? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, he's so good, too.
I know.
What a cast.
Such a great, I know. And that's when the Wooster Group was on fire. I mean, they still are, but
yeah.
You know, Ron Vauder was bad, you know, and they were like, took us under their wing. And anyways, that was a great way to come to New York. And now here I am at the Public again. It's great.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
But have you been there since?
You know, I haven't. I've done readings and stuff, but
right.
I haven't. No.
That's amazing. So it's kind of that much more of a odd kind of just alignment of
yes.
Celestial planets. So I remember going there, and I remember going with a girlfriend and my dad.
Uh-huh.
I took them. I don't know how I had the extra tickets, but we all went, and I really liked it. So anyway, nice to finally meet you.
Right, officially.
You know, 20-some years later.
That's
wow.
right.
Yeah, but you look exactly the same. I'm just going to let people know she looks exactly the same. And, yeah, of course. My podcast is about independent films. So when I heard that you were in Cold Lands and I read about it, this is an opportunity I could maybe meet you and talk to you and bring you on this. And then it turns out, though, the film is also really pretty great, right? Directed by Tom Gilroy. I guess it's not a spoiler to say that your character dies about a third of the way through the film or something like that. When you get a script like that and your character is in it only for a small portion of the film, I'm just wondering, would that play into your feelings about taking the role, or did you just do it because this is a quality screenplay?
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, yeah, it depends, you know? I mean, Tom and I have been friends for over 20 years. So whenever Tom,
really?
Yeah, whenever Tom has something, you know, we had a theater company together and stuff. So whenever he does something, I'm just on. I don't even have to read it.
It's by default.
Exactly.
Exactly. That's pretty great. So you're from Chicago, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The Chicago area.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived there before you moved?
I came here in 88. I lived in the city mm-hmm. for a bit, but I came here to New York in 88.
Okay, yeah. Being hired by Joe Papp and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Was Tom from Chicago area, or did you...
No, I met Tom when I moved here. I think I met Tom in 1990.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been
yeah.
a while.
So
yeah.
But it was right around that time.
Yeah.
So, and what's interesting to me also about the time when you started, around the time you started to make a career out of film acting... Also, it was right on the cusp of this period of this what would become this enormous period of an explosion of independent film. You know, there have been some hints at it before, let's say 88, 89, 90, what have you, right? With Spike Lee and Jarmusch and a couple of others.
Sex Lies and Videotape, I think, was actually. Was that 90?
It was early 90s, right? It was like at least... I always confuse the date. I want to say 90, but they always
basically,
say that
was... Basically, there was Cassavetes and Killer Sheep, and there was just a few. And Wanda and...
Right.
Girlfriends.
Right.
Was... what year was Girlfriends? Was that 85 or 86? The Claudia Wheel?
You know, I'm not sure about that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, and so, yeah, there was not many.
No.
I didn't think.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I guess it was, but I mean, Spike Lee was, let's say, already making some films in the 80s and right, late 80s and Jarmusch, too.
Since the
mid 80s.
Yeah.
But they were, you know, they were like wandering around in a desert as far as like there was no explosion yet. I guess it was Sex Lies and Videotape that sort of made the news and because of it. It was like bought up, you know, right, by Miramax or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I can't remember all the details. Anyway, long story short is that you started in getting momentum going shortly after that period, right?
Yeah.
And so it was really good, just lucky timing in a way that you probably just never hurt for work, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like I right now just talking about it, it's like I sort of had some gratitude for, you know, being here during that time, because what I feel like I do more is lament the change that started to happen in the late 90s. But, you know, I just realized, wait a minute, I can look at it another way, too, that I got to.
Yeah.
I mean, the only reason I lament it is because I just loved it. I loved that time. It was a fantastic time for filmmakers, for audience, for actors, because you just had your friends and you could do it. And you didn't, the directors weren't burdened with a little list of names of who they had to cast, and, you know, and you know, if you didn't have the if you didn't have the permit, you just found a way to shoot at night, or you just
didn't stop you.
It didn't stop, and it was a great time. It was so creative. That's what it was, and collaborative, and those are the things that I love.
And it was around the late 90s you're referring to, when a lot of the smaller distribution companies went out of business. Is that about,
well,
was that a big part of it? Or
yeah, it was that, but it was a confluence of things, you know. I think that's when, you know, money started to shift. It's when I think there was like a new business section in the Times. I found like the Wall Street probably started to, that was probably shifting. Something was shifting with the capital.
Right.
And it felt like the independent financiers, something had shifted there. And all of a sudden, I think with Pulp Fiction, it feels like that changed something in that you realized it could be a good investment. You didn't have to put a ton in, and you could make some back, you know?
Yeah.
And so something shifted there, and then they started to think that they could say who, they could sort of have an artistic say in things, you know, or say like, well, this is what you're going to have to do, or who you have to have in it if you want to.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden the vision is being impaired, you know, in some way of the director.
Yeah. So how did that affect the work you were doing, or the parts you were choosing?
Well, that's where I just felt like there wasn't as much opportunity, because now a lot of other actors had come into the game, because it became a cool thing to do indies, you know, and people wanted to. And and then, of course, if you had an Academy Award, or you had a foreign film that did well, you're going to look a little better on the sheet, you know.
Yeah.
No offense. I mean, there's some actresses who, you know, they were the right one for the part or whatever, but I felt like there was sometimes these lists that the actresses always weren't the right ones for the part, but they were, the investors wanted them, and that felt kind of lousy.
What do you think now, though, there in the last, I'd say, 5 years or so, there seems to be, there is, with the more accessibility and inexpensive nature to at least shooting a film, that there's another sort of wave of low-budget, you know, micro-budget cinema. But it also spawned, like, Girls, for instance. A series like Girls kind of comes out of that. And there's, you know, it's now, of course, floods festivals like South by Southwest, you know, a very large festival. And then there's many other festivals now that are kind of thriving. In fact, a lot of small films, the festivals become an alternate distribution for them. because they're having a problem getting conventional distribution.
Right.
There's such a glut. But there's a lot of great films. How often are you approached about doing micro-budget films, for instance?
You know, not that much.
Really?
But, yeah, I'd like to be.
Really?
Because I find them exciting. And, and you know, I think art's going to always go in cycles, and it's always going to go above ground and then underground.
Right.
You know, and the good news is that, you know, the mainstream has gotten more interesting, you know. There's, you know, if we look at the films in the Academy Awards now versus...
Yeah.
I felt like it started to shift with, like, Fargo or Boys Don't Cry or somewhere around there when I started to see films getting in that would never, or performances getting in that would never have gotten in before.
Right.
You know, and that's exciting. That's great, you know. And but then it's for mumblecore or whatever the next little movement is to then start getting underground and pushing up and so on, you know.
One of the films that I recall very, very vividly that I saw that you did was the Bob Goss film with Julie Johnson. And I just, because I saw it actually not that long ago. Boy, I love that. I thought that was an amazing film. And I was surprised that it's like that not a lot more people seem to
Something happened with the distribution
was
there.
Was that what it was?
Yeah. Yeah, Shooting Gallery got in legal problems.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And something happened, and it didn't really get distributed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, everybody should see it, and you can see it now. I mean, at least it's on. I know it's on Netflix, for instance.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. No, it's really tremendous. It's a great film and a great performance.
Great,
really,
thank you.
Really moving.
Thank you.
And I was talking to Yeah, Hal Hartley recently, who is going to have a new film out this year. Have you had a chance to work with him?
No.
Oh, okay. That's another thing. I'll have to make a note. We'll get that fixed. Don't worry.
Good.
And he was saying, yeah, that there was a recent documentary made about the shooting gallery. Mm. And he chose not to participate, I guess, because his experience at the time, you know, there was a company that was having quite a few problems, I guess, around this. Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about Coldlands,
mm-hmm.
I guess, since this is coming out Friday, right? Mm-hmm. It's coming out mm-hmm. this Friday, isn't mm-hmm. it? Right, unless I'm mistaken, the 14th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. It was shot upstate?
Yeah.
Up here in New York, right?
Yeah, upstate New York. Yeah.
And how was that experience?
Well, I have a house across the river on the Hudson, the other side of the Hudson.
Yeah.
Mid-Hudson Valley.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, and so Tom's more in the Catskill area and mountains area, and it was great. I would just drive across. Not so great because it was during Irene, actually, and upstate got
okay.
hit really bad,
yeah, no, it did.
Particularly the west. Yeah. West of the Hudson. So that was actually tricky getting to work. And of course, just awful for that area because they suffered a lot. But it was familiar stomping ground for me.
Yeah.
So that was great.
Was that like crossing at Newburgh?
Or? Exactly.
Kidding around because, I mean. You know,
I would cross the Kingston Bridge to get to Tom's. Yeah.
Kingston, very good. And the son decides to run off after his mom dies. And it becomes a big part of the film is that part of the state.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Hmm.
It becomes sort of, to me, like a big part of the story in a way, the landscape. Just a thought. But how was working with this young man?
Great. I mean, Tom had been working with him for a year.
So he knew that he had this actor?
Yeah.
And he had been coaching him and working with him?
Yeah.
Because he hadn't worked before?
Right.
Okay.
Right. He lived.
But he looks so familiar. It's odd.
Yeah, I think he has that look. He lived right near Tom upstate.
Okay.
Yeah. And Tom knew his family. And so, again, I feel like Tom was keeping me abreast of sort of where Silas was at, Silas had changed a bit through the year and, mm-hmm. you know, things that worked for him and things that didn't. You know, and I mean, I know kids and the like kids, and I know you got to be authentic, first of all.
Sure.
You know, anything but, and you know, they can smell a rat a mile away. So, but I also know that you have to find ways to get in that they may not know that they may not know your technique, but like, for instance, he loved his farm animals. He loved his ducks and his lambs. And so I knew that was going to be a way. Or sports, and I like sports, so it's not like I'm being false,
right?
Because
right.
I can talk sports with him, you know. But
so you're just talking as another actor,
exactly, as
gotcha.
A friend,
okay,
as a friend, just to get him comfortable
and create a chemistry together,
yeah.
a comfortable level of right, because he was out of his element.
Exactly.
Was he familiar with your work at all? Or?
I doubt it.
And what was the vibe on the set? Does Tom create? Because it's kind of a heavy duty story. I mean, and then there's always this level of, and then he basically bonds, his character bonds with a loner or a, I shouldn't say a loner, but sort of an outlier like this right? The other guy. And I was wondering what kind of vibe he creates on the set, what kind of director he is in that way.
Well, I mean, very intimate and, you know, we would eat at his house upstate. He opened up his house to everybody.
Okay. So at the end of the day, you guys would drive back? And
yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
You were on the other side, you were saying, right?
So I would drive over.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah, and all the locations were pretty close.
Yeah.
And we would, you know, eat it in his kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he tried to make the food really nice. He had
right.
people that worked in the town cook the food, you know. So very community-oriented.
Yeah.
And very, as I say, intimate. So respecting the whole crew that's there and like a family, setting up a comfortable environment, which is great. Like an independent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's a story that could have gotten very melodramatic. It could have gotten very sentimental.
Yeah.
Or
pretentious.
Or just, yeah, it had that potential. But it really, I mean, there's a sentimentality to it in the broader sense, but not in the performances.
No.
Which I really appreciated because, I mean, you're thinking, oh, this poor kid at this point in his life loses his mother, and then there's almost no time to kind of process it for him, and he kind of just runs off into the woods.
Well, that was a big thing at Tom's, was that he talking to kids, none of them cry when their parents die, except when they're with adults, because they feel that that's what they should be doing.
Really?
Yeah. And so Tom did a lot of great things like that, just finding out the authenticity of it, you know, and making sure to go there and not to the sentimental or the idea we have of a kid.
Do you have your parents?
Yeah, I have. My mom's alive, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, the movie's called The Cold Lands, and it stars Lily Taylor, of course, but it opens on Friday the 14th here in New York.
Yeah.
So I do also want to talk a little bit more about the play.
Sure.
It's at the Public. The name, again, is The Library. And this has just been announced, right, that you're...
Yeah, I mean, we're rehearsing, but we're a couple of weeks into rehearsal.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who else is in it?
Chloe Moretz.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. And some great Jennifer Westfeldt and Michael O'Keefe. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you been doing a lot of theater? I know it's your first time back at the Public. Since we met in 1980. I'm just wondering, is it your first time back? Or I don't know, have you been doing theater all along in New York anyway,
right? Yeah.
Like between films?
Yeah, definitely. I've done a couple things at Williamstown. That's been a nice place to work, too. I've done some summers there. And I try to do a play once a year, once every couple of years.
Yeah.
For sure. I love theater. Love it.
Do you have a preference in terms of the kind of... do you like doing... period pieces at all, or do you like the contemporary story?
I think that, you know, theater's hard and it doesn't usually pay, so it's really wanting to do something either that where I'm going to be, where the vision is really interesting, mm-hmm. or where I'm, you know, working my chops, or there's got to be something going on. So a period piece only if the director's got something really interesting, you know, to do with it,
right?
You know.
But this is certainly a great opportunity to work with Steven Soderbergh. I don't know, has he done much theater?
I think it's his second play.
It's his second one?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's still new for him, you know?
And to be at the Public, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure for him anyway, you know.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But he's in his element, I assume.
Pardon?
He's in his element, I assume.
He is and isn't. I mean, he's very, you know, I think when we get into tech, he's going to be in his element.
Right.
He's great. But I can just tell, I have a feeling that he needs to see the lights and the sound and for his, you know, because that's how he lives in some ways,
sure.
you know?
Right. Very good point. Yeah. What is the play about? Again, it's called The Library.
It's kind of loosely based on Columbine.
Okay.
Yeah, but not on the killers. It's on the survivors, like on a, particularly focusing on a girl, Chloe Moretz, who survived.
I see.
And has a very different version of events than the version that the town wants to believe, which is that my daughter who died went out this martyr, as a martyr, because I'm religious. My daughter's, you know, part of that youth group, What Would Jesus Do? And that's the story we want to have told. And the girl who survived has a very different story. So it's kind of about truth and different versions of one's truth.
Wow. And when is it scheduled?
For previews, the 25th, I think.
25th
of March.
Of March already?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That seems to me rather quick.
It is.
Like, is that normal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But we have a month of previews. We have a month of previews.
And then, of course, you tweak or...
We tweak every day because we have rehearsals during previews. So,
sure.
And you're paying less, so you're going to get some mistakes, you know?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll have to come and see it because... It'll be a bit of a reunion for you.
Yes.
And for me, too.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's funny. I grew up in New York, and my folks belonged to the Public for years. And they would take me, Lily, to plays that you have no business taking a small child to. I mean, I'm talking about, like, you know, literally they took me to see Short Eyes. Literally. Yeah. And I it was like 10, you know.
Wow.
And they would take me to see, like, Sticks, like David Rabe plays.
Oh, my God.
Growing up and going to the Public Theater, and you'd go there and you'd see these actors. I didn't know. Really, that I mean, I kind of had a sense, oh, this is special, but you know, I realized it, but I didn't want to be watching some of these plays. They were pretty intense.
That's wild.
But yeah, so it was a lot of
what a time.
Glad I at least know that I saw them.
Yeah, you did. I got in there.
So in about, you know, when I was finally, and I was hit my young adulthood and I was on my own, one of the first things I did, because it was relatively inexpensive in 88 to join the public theater and to go.
So carry on the tradition.
They were still doing so much great theater there, and I'm not saying they're not now, but it seemed like it was still a bit like under, you know.
Yeah. Definitely. He's downtown. Yeah.
Anyway, so Cold Lands is going to be March 14th, and the look for the library, right? Because it's going to be in previews moment towards the end of March. And then,
that's right.
And we'll wish you, I wish you all the luck with all of that, then.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for making time to come on this podcast.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You better save yourself from something you can't see. Follow it where it goes. Follow it back to me. I'll keep it here. Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
Lily Taylor, I guess, you know, I'm going to try to follow up with her and, you know, and make sure she comes to Rooftop Films this summer and get her back on. I felt a little nervous. I don't know why, you know. I just felt like, you know, I should probably have. What it is, you know, guys, is that I did not have enough time with her. I got to have at least a good half hour, and I really just didn't have long enough to really delve into stuff that I normally would have let the conversation go about. I would have let a conversation go a little deeper, and I just didn't quite have enough time, but I still love meeting her and love talking to her, and I hope you got something out of that. Okay, so next up here are these two great programmers. Dennis Lim is from the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and Yuta Jensen has been at MoMA in the film department for quite a while, and they are among the six of the selection committee behind New Directors, New Films, which is going to be having their opening night on March 19th. The film series runs right through the end of the month through March 30th, and there's quite a few great, great films in the series, of course, and you're going to hear about quite a few of them coming up right now. Just really thrilled to be sitting here with Yuta Jensen from the MoMA Film Department and Dennis Lim from the Film Society of Lincoln Center to talk about the encroaching new directors, new films. What season are we up to? Like 80, 90? No, I'm kidding. I'm
43.
Exact. 43. Hold on. Yuta, hold the mic up there. You can talk for a few minutes. I've seen, I've been to more than a few of them. Makes me old. I'm still older than the festival, though.
That's good to know. I don't know if Dennis is. No, he is. But it is a very long collaboration between these two organizations and a very successful one, we feel. It's really something that I think I can speak for both of us, that our organizations look forward to every year. It is both because then it will finally be spring, but it's also so that we get to work together and get to discuss films from all over the world. And we really have this great committee, six people, three people from each organization. Mm-hmm. And it's really fun. Everybody has their different tastes, their different things that they want to especially vote for and talk for. Mm-hmm. And we have some very spirited discussions, and I think we come up every year, and I think certainly this year, with a very rich and very diverse program because of everybody's input and different tastes.
Seems so. having read through the program. But let's be honest, it's a blood sport, right? You guys, when you're powering it out, right? It gets bloody, doesn't it?
It gets I don't know if it gets ugly. I know,
yeah.
But yes, we are very passionate people,
yeah, right.
And we certainly will defend very passionately what we believe should be in there, and. It's unavoidable that some of your favorite films maybe doesn't get in there, but then you just blame yourself because you weren't good enough to argue them.
Oh, I see. Very good. Okay. See, now we're getting into the mind of what programmers do have to cope with. Dennis, was there a film that made it in? We wouldn't want to point one out that didn't, but is there a film in the program that you fought for?
Oh, I don't know that I should be picking favorites from a lineup.
Maybe you're right there.
That's
That might be hard because we won't necessarily be able to touch on every single film.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about favorite films, but I don't want to single out necessarily as films that people fought for. But just to go back to Yuta's point, it does get very heated. But there are also some films in here that I think we can say are unanimous choices. There are films that we all six people agreed that we should show. And there were some films that had very strong support from a few people, which made a difference because of how passionate they were. The process forces you to really think about through why you support a film, and why you want to show it and make the case to your colleagues. And I think that's actually very valuable, something very valuable about this committee process.
Well, other than, let's say, an emotional response to a film, a strong emotional response, what other types of things are you referring to that might go into that, like wanting to champion a film?
I think it does often start with a strong emotional response, but I think there are also different reasons to show a film. I mean, we're putting together a slate, which is it's actually a fairly small one. We typically show about 25 features. This year we have 27. So it is about putting together a lineup that is, as Yuta says, has some diversity to it, but also I think has a point of view behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes really becomes clear once you've started the process and you're a little bit of the way in. And I think we'll have different ideas about how that shaping of the program should, what we should do to shape the program, what kinds of films we need. We might have different ideas about that, and then we'll talk it through in those terms as well. So it's not just about I like this film, I want it in. It's just that I like this film because it is...
It's contextual.
You put it in conversation with other films that are already in the program.
Sure. So other than the fact that, of course, the majority, if not all of the films are made by new filmmakers, maybe this is their first or second work, Are there other, I don't want to say parts of the agenda that you guys have with new directors?
We don't have an agenda because we really don't, yes, which is, I think, setting us very free. And what we look for is innovation and people who work with the making their films in new and surprising ways. We try to find filmmakers from around the world, and we are really very intent on being very international.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of what we really like about this festival, is that it is truly a commitment to international independent cinema. But we try to find people who, like, for instance, this year I think there is not two films that are alike. And that's really very nice. Everybody comes with a personal point of view. Everybody comes with a way that they play with the form of the way their film, whether it's documentary, whether it's somewhat science fiction, whether it's a fiction film. It comes with a new approach to that particular genre. And that's what makes it exciting for us also.
And one other question before I know we do want to get into talking about some of the highlights or some of the films, and we do want to repeat. Thank you. We do also want to remind people that the ones we're choosing, we love all of our children the same, as the expression goes. Right? We don't. But I wonder if there is in this what appears after however many seasons, you said, I think 43, excuse me, that there's obviously a symbiotic relationship between these two organizations, between the Film Society and MoMA. Can you articulate what each of those organizations brings to? Is it that different, or is it?
Well, I think, you know, even though it's a 43-year collaboration mm-hmm. and a very strong, long-standing one, there are different people on the committee. I mean, this is my first year on the committee.
Oh, is that right?
So, mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely turnover over the years. MoMA has had different programmers on the committee over the years as well. Same thing here. But, you know, Yuta's been doing it longer than I have, so maybe she can speak more to the sort of partnership aspect.
This is actually the first year where Larry Kadish, who was one of the founders of New Directors, New Films, mm-hmm. is no longer on the committee.
Oh,
he
wow.
has retired.
Okay.
But it's kind of strange because all the time I've been on, Larry has been a big part of New Directors. But I think it's very true what Dennis says, that it really depends on this kind of growing group of people who for every year there's few new people, and I think that that makes it also very alive and experimental for us
right.
To be on the committee and to choose the films. I think it also gives us different perspectives because everybody in the two organizations, when they do their organizatorial work mm-hmm. within the organization, they have different parts of expertise, they have different ways of putting together their programs, and all this we collectively bring to this festival, and that makes it very special, I think.
It is very special. I apologize for keep postponing the talk about the specific films, but I also want to ask about the festivals that you guys scour through. Clearly you go to Sundance, and clearly I would assume Toronto, Rotterdam. What about Berlin? Because that was just ended, and I wonder if there's time to include that in your, because your festival's so early in the year.
We actually have films from that premiered in Berlin this year, and we also have films that were in Berlin last year.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, Berlin is a bit tricky. It depends on when we get to see the films. So I would say the cycle typically starts in Cannes for us. We have several titles from last year's Cannes.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Locarno. I think most of the MoMA team went to Toronto. And most of us went to Sundance. And a couple of us from the Film Society side went to Rotterdam. So I think, you know, that sort of, well, these are the main festivals. But we obviously also do, you know, outreach to various contacts around the world,
sure.
Other programmers, you know, various producers, sales agents, et cetera, who we've worked with over the years. The Berlin question is, I mean, it's this year we were able to see a few films before Berlin started. We closed this lineup just before the Berlinale begins, but we were able to see two films, History of Fear and She's Lost Control, which just premiered last month. But we have two films, Strange Little Cat and Youth, that were in Berlin last year, which we, you know, still haven't shown in New York, and we thought we absolutely should show them.
I look forward to seeing both of those, too. Well, now that we are talking about specific films, let's continue getting into it. Do you want to start maybe with the opening night, since that's sort of self-evident, I guess?
Yes.
Which is on the 19th?
That is
right?
The
19th of March?
Yes.
Okay.
It's going to be in MoMA.
Mm-hmm.
And A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. It's the film that we're opening with. It's with by a young California mm-hmm. filmmaker, Anna Lily Amirpour. And she has fashioned a really terrific, great-looking black and white, very stylish widescreen film that totally circumvents your expectations, certainly of the title, which sounds like this girl walking home alone at night would be a victim and couldn't be farther from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to tell you too much about that. This is
fair enough.
This is a take on the vampire genre, which will surprise you and delight you. It's also beautifully imagined and also has really emotional impact. The two leads are really a very, very great-looking couple, and
mm-hmm.
What happens to them, you really follow with the sort of a pain in your stomach. Will they make it or won't they?
So there's two screenings of that on that.
On
is it
the
a Wednesday?
19th, yes.
Wednesday the 19th.
Yes.
At MoMA.
Yeah.
Titus 1 and 2.
It's 7 and at 8, exactly.
Oh, at 7 and at 8, excuse
yes.
me. Okay. So heads up, right? Are there tickets still available for those?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we shall
not
also
too
mention.
Many, but yes. Okay. There are still tickets available.
Right. So rush and start to take notes now. So when this ends, the segment ends, you can go to either the Film Society's website or MoMA and purchase tickets. Or the new directors.
And all those website, newdirectors.org.
I'll give all those options also on my notes. Yeah.
That's great.
It'll be link-tastic or whatever. Okay, well, I have not seen that film, and I'm looking forward to it now. It's amazing how many times it seems that, first of all, there's a fascination with this particular type of genre, the vampire story, and how many times it's kind of been retold and reimagined. You know, and so well. I mean,
right.
I know Jim Jarmusch has another one coming out later this year.
Yeah, it's really the genre of choice right now. But this one is very,
sure
very
is.
Unusual because it also has like a heavy Western influence. It's as much about Western, talking about Jim Jarmusch, which is where he also usually sets some of his films.
Right.
But she's working also with the Western genre, which is a marvelous way that she's reinventing that as well. And then it's also a compact metaphor for Iran. So there's a lot to chew on there. And at the same time, it's just this beautiful, gorgeously stylized film that you just never want to end.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's high praise. What's another, something else that we can talk about? Another film?
I think just jumping off on that, the points that Yuta made, I think these are not really just genre exercises, but I think a film like Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is something that I think really does reanimate the genre and is very aware of its tropes and puts them to use in very creative ways. And I think we have a lot of films this year that do that. We do have some, you know, I would say more what you might call genre films than we typically do. There's a horror movie that was at Sundance called The Babadook, which was very well received there, and we're very happy to be showing that. Mm-hmm. And we have a very Baroque European horror film called The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears by a Belgian couple filmmaker. Their previous film, Amer, was a new director's 4 years ago. And actually just, you know, I think one, Yuta referred to A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night as a sort of a metaphor for Iran. We actually, and the director is Iranian-American, we do actually have a film from Iran that also works as, a metaphor for the situation there, which is Fish and Cat, which is also, I think, in a way, a kind of genre, a take on genre. It's a one-take movie. It's over 2 hours, but it's a single take, incredibly well orchestrated. It sort of flirts with a lot of slasher conventions. It's about a group of young people at a campsite, and two mysterious men arrive, and you know, there's a lot of foreboding and dread, and but the whole thing is orchestrated in one single take, and it's from an Iranian filmmaker, named Shahram Mulkery.
That last one that comes to mind like that is Russian Ark, maybe. That was as ambitious.
Well, actually, there was a one-take film in New Directors last year called People's Park, which was
Very good.
Yeah, a documentary. A tourist
one-take documentary.
Yeah, set shot in a park in China, which the filmmakers shot actually with an improvised dolly. They used a wheelchair. This is also a fairly Fish and Cat is fairly, I think, fairly low budget film, but very, very interesting too.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of humor also.
Humor
in new directors, new films this year. Yes, The Centerpiece by Gillian Robespierre.
Obvious Child.
Obvious Child is also a discovery from Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
It's really smart, very. Very potent film that uses humor to talk about a serious subject matter, women's reproductive rights. It's really the stand-up comedy is made by Jenny Slate, and it's really a career performance. She's going to make it big after this film. She's terrific.
Yeah, you can see the writing on the wall.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We are doing a special centerpiece screening of that out at PS1.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yes, MoMA's affiliate in Queens, like from Brooklyn to Queens, sort of.
Queens getting a little deserved attention. For
absolutely.
For, yeah. So that's it's a funny film.
That has a lot of humor in it.
Okay, let's put
that. It's really hilarious.
Oh, okay.
Film, yes.
Oh, right.
But there are other films that are maybe less hilarious, but also uses humor to get a point across.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Icelandic film of Horses and Men.
Oh, right. That is very funny.
Is a really lovely example of that. It sort of looks for the beast in the human and the human in the beast, and uses small Icelandic horses to make a correlation, certainly in the way of courting rituals between horses and humans. And then it is set in this glorious Icelandic nature, which also the filmmaker very cleverly uses to talk about how close we still are to being animalistic nature beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite beautiful and quite funny.
I can attest to that firsthand. I watched it. I was at the press screening the other day for it, and it's one of those films where you laugh and then you're shocked. They throw in it's kind of told through a series of vignettes in a way that are all obviously interconnected, that all deal again with horses and men or people, but there's at least three or four moments where you're literally aghast from what you're watching. It's a lot of visual humor in it. I highly recommend that film too, Mr. Lim. Another. Well, we could talk about the closing night, or we talk about the shorts, or we can.
Sure. I'll talk about the. The closing night film is 20,000 Days on Earth, by Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, who are two British filmmakers who come from the art world. It's a film, it's a documentary of sorts about Nick Cave. It's probably better to say it's a portrait of Nick Cave, made in collaboration with Cave.
Mm-hmm.
There's some amazing footage of Cave and his band, The Bad Seeds, recording their most recent album. But it's really by no means a conventional music doc. There's some studio and live footage that's really wonderful. But I think the most interesting thing about this film is how it sets up these scenes that sort of play with his own self mythology. They're very stylized scenes. There's some scenes that appear to be acted, scripted. You see him, looking through his own archives, reminiscing with friends in these very dreamy scenes where he's driving people like Kylie Minogue around in his car. I think a very ambitious film in terms of its form, but I think it's also one that will definitely appeal to fans of Nick Cave.
Yeah, there seem to be a number of films in the last few years also that are kind of playing with the profile documentary a little bit.
Yeah, there's a number here as well. Stop the Pounding Heart, for instance, by Roberto Minervini. This is his second in a planned trilogy on Texas. He's an Italian-born filmmaker who has made Texas his second home. And he films with a handheld camera. He befriends people in his immediate area.
Mm-hmm.
Using a handheld camera, he gets very close to them because he becomes part of their family, part of their way of living.
Mm-hmm.
He gets these amazing performances by his actors. They're not really actors because they play themselves,
mm-hmm.
but he does play with the form in the sense that he inserts a slight narrative thread into these people's lives.
Yeah.
It's done incredibly well done, and it also, this film, Stop the Pounding Heart, also has a really, really amazing emotional impact because you have this young woman who's at the cusp of being, we have this young girl who's the cusp of being a woman, having been raised from strict strictly brought up by the, her parents, who have 12 children, and using the scriptures as their guide for their education of mm-hmm. their children. She now has met a young boy who is in the rodeo and comes from a different milieu that she does, and she feels some things that she hasn't been explained to her by her mother, who mm-hmm. otherwise tells her how she should behave and what she should expect from life as a woman. And it's not a nice picture she's actually painting of that. But the young girl is really the way that she acts without saying anything. Minervini gets this revolt that is brewing in her against the fixed mm-hmm. Life that she's right. growing up to expect. It's really beautifully done. I think he's going to bring the young girl the young boy.
Wow.
And even the parents, because mm-hmm. The way that he gets into depicting these people's lives, he is very careful by giving every one of his people, every one of the people of the persons that he depicts, a lot of care and understanding mm-hmm. for the complexity of their lives and their beliefs. Yeah. So nobody feels exploited.
No. Right, or ambushed in any way.
Right.
And the name of that one again, Yuta, was?
That is Stop the Pounding Heart.
Stop the Pounding Heart. Well, I'll be sure to check that one out, too. Did you have another one to talk about? Or
I think very much in that vein is mm-hmm. a French film called Mouton, Mouton. Sheep, mm-hmm. which is also, I think, a very... it's a fiction film, but one that sort of uses non-actors and plays like documentary. I think it's very observational in terms of how this character, the central character, is a young man who's nicknamed Mouton, Sheep, and it's sort of takes shape as this very subtle observational portrait of his life, but then something very shocking happens in the middle of the film, which I won't reveal, that I think really changes the course of it. It's I think what I don't want to play favorites, but this is a film that really surprised me, actually, I would say, when I first saw it. I don't think I've quite seen a film that uses these documentary techniques in the service of narrative in quite in this way before.
All right, we'll repeat the disclaimer. None of these are necessarily favorites. We are just discussing arbitrary moments,
a selection of highlights.
Selection of highlights, if you will. Thank you. So I have a quite. Unless you can jump in, of course, if you have another one you're excited to talk about. But and by the way, you know, also you can when one chooses how to talk about a festival, it is kind of almost like you're using particular ones that, in a way, you're also curating a conversation around. So there are certain films that will you can speak well of the festival. Some others are might harder to talk about, but are equally as worthwhile. You know. I know that's something I've run into. You know, I was talking to Sally Berger, your colleague, a few weeks back, went right around the time of Doc Fortnite, and she was saying how, you know, that you go through this process of excavation to find your films for this, you know, let's say new directors, and themes sort of start to emerge that you may have not have anticipated, or maybe you even saw them in retrospect, that these, all of a sudden you're looking at these films and you're seeing all of a sudden a larger theme coming out of it. I don't know if that's something that is a phenomenon that you notice with this particular season or in general, or is that too obtuse a question?
No, I think we've sort of already touched on some of them. You know, with a festival like this, we definitely do not go out looking for themes or for... It all really just starts with films that move us, impress us, you know, just that we're taken with in some way, and we bring those to the table. But... we definitely did notice some of the things that we talked about, just interesting takes on genre, mm-hmm. Sort of films that play with, you know, documentary and narrative. There are also films maybe not even substantial enough to count as you know, themes, but you'd have mentioned Obvious Child as a comedy that, you know, a sort of serious-minded comedy, a comedy that's actually about something. We have another American film, Dear White People, that I think is a very interesting and funny film about race relations.
It got a lot of press that Sunday.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, I think those two could be interesting to think about together. Mouton and Stop the Pounding Heart, as I said, and also the various takes on sort of on horror that that we've seen in the lineup. There's another Argentinian film, History of Fear, which is sort of like a play on sort of more, you know, domestic horror, much more subtle take on that. But yeah, they're definitely very, you know, you do look at a lineup and then you see that there are connections that were always there. I don't think anything was put in just because we felt like, oh, there's something else.
Right. That's why
like
I kind of
that.
No, that's why I kind of said it kind of emerges through the process as opposed to like some sort of, again, agenda is a good word to dismiss from this whole thing because it doesn't apply in this festival.
I also wanted to talk just a little bit about the two more conventional, without being conventional, documentaries that we have. Return to Homes is a Syrian film inside the Homs, which is this city that had been bombed to the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
It follows a singer, and he's also the very popular goalkeeper on the a national football soccer team,
mm-hmm.
And his friend, who is a videographer, and it follows how they transform from peaceful protesters to the armed resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And we are with them inside mm-hmm. The bombed-out buildings of Homs when they go back and try to defend the city that they love so much. I don't think that there has really been a documentary that is so fully immersing the audience into active fighting. And I think that this would turn out to be a really important film and information for anybody who wants to follow what is happening politically in Syria, but with a human perspective. It's also made very intimately by Talal Derki and some of his friends who have several cameras where they follow these young resistance fighters. Another one is Herbert Sauber's We Come As Friends.
Mm-hmm.
He's the great director of Darwin's Nightmare that was nominated for an Oscar several years ago. This is his second film. It's rather different from the first. It even has sort of a sci-fi element to it.
Mm.
It's very interesting the way that he arrives in Africa and Sudan in this self-built flying machine. You can barely call it a plane.
Mm-hmm.
He and his there's something very homemade about this plane because it is homemade.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way that he sort of arrives in this war-torn country and try to figure out the other people who arrive as friends.
Mm-hmm.
Are they really friends or foe, or is this just another way of making money out of an African, a poor African country? And he also makes a beautiful documentary really takes the mask off a number of organizations and people in trying to get something out for themselves from Sudan. But mm-hmm. he also makes a beautiful film with taking footage from the flying machine as they come through the African airspace, and sort of fashions sci-fi ambience to this almost incredible ball that he interviews and finds ready to pillage this nation.
Hmm.
It's very beautifully done, but is, I think, more of a traditional documentary, just also playing with the form in his particular way.
Huh. Well, it sounds like some of these Q&As are going to be definitely very engaging and a big part of what's going to make these events special, because to talk to like that filmmaker, for instance,
right.
seems like a really unique opportunity.
No, I think that that is what is wonderful also about new directors. And mm-hmm. this year we are extremely fortunate that everyone is coming except one. It's the Iranian director, and we. It's not that he couldn't
Understood.
Get a visa per se. Uh-huh. It's just that it couldn't happen right at this time. Yes.
Okay.
But that's, we're sad, of course, that he couldn't come. But it's great that all the others are coming, because in every film, there's a lot to discuss. Form, content, how did you make it? How there's a lot of these films that are co-productions. I think that this is very much how it is now with international filmmaking, independent filmmaking, that you need to have finances and you need to have support from various sources.
Of
and I'm sure that people would be interested in hearing also about this.
So for the film lover, New Directors, New Films, which again is now going into its 43rd season, starting March 19th, it's a great opportunity to see films that have been played out in the festivals around the world in the last year, and with maybe some other films too thrown in, and of course, all, as we said, a lot of the filmmakers, or almost all the filmmakers, will be in attendance too. Events will take place both at MoMA and at the Film Society, mostly at the Walter Reed, I assume, but...
All our screenings here are at the Walter Reed.
At the Walter Reed. And so, again, and tickets are available now at either MoMA's website, Film Society of Lincoln Center's website, or the New Director's website. Go to that one. I think that's easiest of all. It sounds like Split the Difference. So thank you, Yuta and Dennis, for finding time in the schedule of these last days. And we'll dedicate this segment to Larry, right? And all of his many years putting together a terrific festival and New Directors, New Films. So thank you both.
Thanks.
Coming to the New Directors, shoot me a note. Let me know, because I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there quite a bit. I'm going to try to make a few movies. I really love it. This year, I wasn't able to do as much traveling at the beginning of 2014. So I'm very happy to finally, the festivals are about to hit New York, like New Directors and then Tribeca. So at least I get to see some quite a bit of stuff coming up. And then hopefully maybe a little bit later in the spring and summer, I can start to do a little bit more traveling again. I do get it in my blood. And I just love to see festivals in different cities. Anyway, coming up right now, Eliza Hittman is back. She was here this last summer. And now on the cusp of her theatrical engagement, which I think is starting in New York on the 21st of March, Eliza is back on my show. So here is my conversation with filmmaker Eliza Hittman. How you doing, Eliza?
I'm doing okay. It's been a dark winter.
Oh my God, the endless winter. You know, though, I was as a little flurry was going on yesterday, and I was looking out the window, and it was so beautiful. I was like, this is. I don't really even care.
I don't even feel cold anymore. I've just gotten used to it.
Yeah, your body's adjusted. So now, of course, it's something to talk about that we can all share. That's not terribly controversial. But the truth is, it's just like, this is the winters I remember from my youth. I don't know about you.
Of course, I grew up in Montana. I remember one with this much snow. Oh, Montana.
No, I'm kidding.
No. I feel like we've had a blizzard every other day.
It's kind of true. It's kind of true.
Also, just not much sun. I think in Montana, there's sun, but snow.
Actually, the sun generates the snow in Montana, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. Well, welcome back to Film Wax Radio.
Thank you for having me and inviting me.
It's a pleasure. You're flying solo this time.
Yes.
Let's recount. Last time you were here was during the summer on a very hot day,
yes,
as opposed to today. And you were with Gina
Persanti.
Persanti.
And Giovanna Salameni.
That's right. It was a colorful show. And I was really thrilled you brought them. I think they really both contributed to the...
They had a lot of fun doing it.
Did they? Uh-huh. Did you ever hear about the response about the show? Because I was... gotten better about
following. I think it was more about the experience of doing it than I don't know if they ever listened to it necessarily, but you know.
Yes. Well, that's more my that's the response I'm used to getting from people.
It's, you know, they're young.
I'm just joking.
No.
Anyway, you had a BAM Cinema Fest screening, and what's gone on since? I mean, we should mention we're looking right off the top that we're looking at a theatrical here in New York. Coming up later in March.
Yes.
Right?
Our film is opening, It Felt Like Love is opening on March 21st at IFC Center.
Nice. And Variance is the...
Yeah, Variance is distributing the film.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, it's one of those things where I just assumed it earlier around the... one of the last times. When I ran into you around the holidays, mm-hmm. right? At a party or something.
And New Year's Eve.
It was New Year's. That's right. Uh-huh. Not just around the holiday. We brought in the New Year together. Uh-huh. And I kind of assumed. I think you mentioned that the theatrical is coming. And I guess I had just assumed. It must have happened. And I, you know, just in the throes of life and stuff that it had. But so it didn't occur to me. You're going to be enjoying maybe the first theatrical of the spring. That's what day is you said again in New York?
It's March 21st.
It is the first day. It's the first eve of spring, I think. And then is it opening in any other cities? Or?
It is. It's opening in Los Angeles on the 28th at the Downtown Independent.
Oh,
and
beautiful.
From there, we'll be at Facets in Chicago.
Oh, I love that theater. Yeah.
And a bunch of other places.
Perfect. So we'll put all that information up on our page.
I can't remember all of them and the dates, but.
Yeah. Well, you can go to the website, It Felt Like Love, the movie.
No, it's just, I think it's just itfeltlikelove.com.
Oh, even better. Itfeltlikelove.com.
Or our Facebook page has all the info.
It's very true, which is facebook.com.
/itfeltlikelove.
It felt like love. It all makes so much sense now. So, all this time later, though, or how do you feel, you know, because you made this film now a couple of, it must be. 2010 and 11?
No, actually, we shot it in August of 2012.
That's remarkable.
I know. It was really, really fast. It was a fast turnover.
Oh, my God.
And I couldn't have done it without, like, such a committed crew.
Yeah. Now that you mention that, these girls are still kind of they're still in their teens, for God's sake. Uh-huh. They're just
they
barely
were, Gina,
teenagers.
Gina was 14 when we shot and 14 when we premiered it. So
she has hopefully an early summer, late spring birthday.
She has a late spring birthday, yeah. Actually, I think she turned 16 this week.
Oh, my gosh. Uh-huh. Happy birthday to Gina. Then.
Yeah.
That is because they didn't look any older than they did in the films. You're right. And normally, yeah. I'm sure by now they do a little bit. Like, I'm sure if I saw them. And I'll try to make it to the IFC Center.
So it was a fast and furious process, and then we were premiering the film in January.
Yeah.
We didn't even have any test screenings. It was like we just showed up to Sundance, and that was the test screening.
It's a remarkable trajectory, then, isn't it? You really got.
I don't think I could do it again like that, but you just like don't have confidence about what's on the screen or what you ended up, you know, agreeing uh-huh. to, and you're just, you know, kind of running on fumes. But it was really exciting.
Yeah, and remind me who the cinematographer is.
Sean Porter. Uh-huh. And he just had another film at Sundance that was in competition, the Zellner Brothers film called Kimiko, yeah. the Treasure.
Oh,
Hunter.
I can't wait to see that film. I just.
Me too.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
Mm-mm.
Let's excited. Go together. Let's
Sounds
go together.
Good.
I'm sure it'll be at Cinema Fest. I have a feeling. Or Rooftop.
Yeah, I don't know yet.
Between Rooftop and Cinema Fest. Come on. Of course. Those guys are so...
I've heard magical things about it.
Me too. Well, I discussed this film with a recent guest. Actually, I think it was Brian Poyser who was sitting right where you're sitting. And we're at the Rooftop offices. But, and we were... Yeah, it was Brian because he's also very close. The Zellners are at least one or two, both of them. I don't know how many brothers there are these days, but they're based in Texas as well. Probably Austin, but mm-hmm. anyway, so they're close friends, and I was saying, yeah, I had read wonderful things about Kimiko, is that what it was called?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, that's the one where she sees Fargo, and mm-hmm. and then it kind of goes apparently into this very strange, quasi, you know, like fantasy almost, right? Because she almost enters, I don't know, she goes to North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds terrific. From Japan to mm-hmm. North.
It looks beautiful. I think it's Sean kind of shows how versatile he is in the film, because our film was shot like on, you know, like a long lens, and it's very close and it's very intimate. And I think in that film, it's like very wide and wide open, you know, more of a sense of space. And
yeah. Well, your film looks terrific. And it holds together. It's a strong film. Tell me about, you wrote it?
I wrote it.
You did write it. And how? Tell me about that process. Like, how did you come up with this idea about, to call it a coming of age story is, of course, the simple, easy way to describe it. But she's very intrigued by this other girl, this friend of hers, who's much more comfortable in her skin sexually and, you know. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Okay. And so she starts exploring this part of herself. But so how did you come up with the idea?
I had a short film at Sundance in 2011 called Forever's Gonna Start Tonight. And it was my graduation film, my thesis from CalArts. And I remember, like, watching all the films that year at Sundance and thinking, like, wow, like, all these movies are, like, very kind of asexual almost, or, like, puritanical. Like, there was no kind of, no sexual exploration, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I went home and I was like, how am I going to go back to Sundance? Like, I really have to do this again. And I didn't think I had, you know, any support to make a feature. And I wrote this short film that was with Lila. And it was, like, about this girl who really was, like, so anxious to, like, have a sort of sexual experience, this young girl, that she sort of experiments with her dog. And I was just trying to be, like, provocative, I guess, and trying to be, like, I don't know, bold. And I threw that away, but I sort of liked the character. And I began sort of just writing episodes about this kind of lonely character, you know, in the middle of the summer, who was trying to form a connection with this guy and sort of devise ways to become close with him. Mm-hmm. And it was very episodic at first. And I sort of used the film to sort of navigate my own memories, I guess, of places that I spent time as, like, an adolescent in Brooklyn. And I felt like kind of an urge to kind of wander through areas of the city in Brooklyn, you know, specifically.
Because did you grow up in?
I grew up in like the middle of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I grew up in a neighborhood called Flatbush that now people call Ditmas Park, but it's not Ditmas Park, actually. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood is broken up into small squares, and actually my square has another name, and Ditmas Park is like another square. But
it helps the real estate folks.
Yeah, it sounds fancy. It has become kind of fancy. But I grew up in the middle of Brooklyn. I went to like big public high school.
Sure.
Called Edward R. Murrow and
famous high school for some of its graduates,
and they had one of the early, like, one of the first schools in the city that had like a television studio, so they did a lot of communications, and they had like a BCAT station where kids like made their own programming for like public access. Anyway, I just thought that like I I'm not like from, I'm from like, you know, pretty middle class, like Brooklyn family. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in, you know, sort of revisiting a lot of locations and stuff that I had spent my youth in that you never see in films. And I think that are like interesting and beautiful and show a certain kind of people that you just sort of see mocked on like reality TV. And
Right. Give them a little bit more humanity, I guess. Uh-huh. Yeah, so no shots on the L line.
No L train, okay, no gotcha. Brooklyn rooftops, no offense, rooftop film. but yeah, no, you know.
Yes, the go-to shots or the more expected and anticipated sort of shots that we're accustomed to.
I wanted to shoot a film, I guess, that was like unrecognizably Brooklyn.
I was just in the neighborhood shopping.
How do I know you again?
The beach.
That's right. You look different.
Yeah.
Do you have a boyfriend?
No.
Kiara's always got boyfriends.
Well, that's different.
Why?
Because she's needy.
Can I ask you something? Do you want something from me?
Did you do something stupid?
I don't know. It's kind of a blur.
How blurry? Did you sleep with him?
Is he your boyfriend?
No, but it's kind of better than a boyfriend, you know?
What are you doing here?
What do you think she's doing here?
What's your name again?
Lila.
Lila? Why don't you come put your ass right here?
To get back to the sexuality part, I want to know also, without prying too much, though, in your own personal life, it's interesting that you saw all this, what you refer to as puritanical kind of stories mm-hmm. coming out of Sundance mm-hmm. at the time, and you were almost, it seems like, a little bit put off,
reaction.
A little annoyed. Yeah,
it was
but
a reaction.
I can understand it. No, I can understand
it. I don't
it's
know
like,
if it was like put off, but it was uh-huh. a reaction.
It was a reaction.
Uh-huh.
It was noticeable.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering also if maybe it was something that you felt that you noticed, as you say, because maybe, I don't know, like, then maybe thought you would also maybe dig something up from yourself and your own, like push your own
and
button,
also like
boundaries.
A lot of the filmmakers that I admire explore like sex in like kind of a challenging and complicated way.
Anybody in particular?
Yeah, like Catherine Briat, I like Francois Ozon, you know, sort of that French kind of group of filmmakers.
Very sexy.
That. The dark side of sort of sex and sexuality.
I just watched Catherine Briat's new film of hers.
How was it?
It was good, but very, very unusual.
Uh-huh.
It was.
Which one is it?
It's called The Abusive Weakness.
Uh-huh.
It's not out yet.
Uh-huh.
It was really good. It was just a very unusual story. So those were some of the filmmakers that you were impressed by
uh-huh.
as you were.
And I was also very practical. I was like, how can I write something that I can make, you know, for nothing?
Yeah. Well, talk about that, because maybe that's a mistake a lot of young filmmakers make. They write something they can't afford to make.
They can't afford to make. I wrote a film knowing that I was going to have no institutional support, knowing that I was going to have, like, no big production companies backing me. And I just figured I would assemble a group of New York City teenagers mm-hmm. in the middle of the summer, make it, like, summer camp,
mm-hmm.
and shoot something,
mm-hmm.
you know, and use locations that I could access for free, and I shot a lot of the film in my parents' basements.
The house where
most of the guy scenes are in my parents' basements.
Oh, yeah.
And then her house is actually my costume designer, Sarah, who I went to high school with. It's her, like, family friend's sort of garden apartment in Sheepshead Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Bensonhurst, sorry.
They're close together.
So, you know, I would integrate things into the film
mm-hmm.
that I felt I could get access to.
Mm-hmm.
Like the beach house belonged to a friend's aunt,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just went there over the summer and I was like, oh, this is so beautiful. Like, and I used to hang out on those beaches growing up and I was like, oh yeah, we definitely would have wanted to like break into one of these houses.
Sure.
So I just kind of kept weaving things into the film that I could access.
And it seemed there's a timelessness. I don't remember seeing a lot of, you know, obvious objects or mm-hmm. references to contemporary
cell phones.
Time. Yes, yeah, I guess there
and
are.
And the music is actually very contemporary.
Mm-hmm. The soundtrack?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's like diegetic sound.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Oh. So there are several trips to the beach during the film, uh-huh. right?
Different beaches, yeah.
Oh, they are?
Uh-huh. Some of it's Rockaway, and then
Rockaway.
They go to Coney Island
mm-hmm.
once.
Mm-hmm.
Waltzly, yeah. It's like a part of Rockaway called Neponset.
Yeah. Well, for those anybody listening should go back and search out our earlier interview, too, because there were some very funny stories about your early screenings. And just because of the nature, it's sensitive, you know. I mean, when you have young women and they're just coming into their own sexuality and just growing up, you know, and exploring these very personal things, that the last people that want to see a movie about it are the parents of those young ladies, you know. So
well, the dads the moms have
they reacted a little bit more. They could connect a little bit.
The moms
they
had a little more distance and were, you know, just proud.
Right.
The dads felt this kind of like protective.
Yeah. Well, these are the conversations uh-huh. we're having with. By the way, the mothers were saying, you know, uh-huh. it's like but the dads. I know, because I'm like, as a parent, I'm realizing I got to talk to my kid about this stuff. I can't really not. I mean, I can't wait around for him to broach
uh-huh.
it. I need to broach it with him. You know, he's 9. He's
uh-huh.
turning 10 and shortly, but
uh-huh.
he has. He doesn't like want to talk to me about these things very much. And then I'll get a call from his mother, And she'll say, oh, well, we talked about this and that. And I'm like, there's no, how, why is he telling you all, asking you all these things and telling you all these things? And he won't, you know, it's like shocking because it's like he's thinking about this. And I keep asking him, what's on your mind? You know, and he just doesn't, I'm the dad. He should feel comfortable talking to me about this stuff.
I think it'll maybe personally shift in a year or two.
Well, I hope so. Well, but he spends also much more time there. But, mm-hmm. but you know, we're more having the fun, you know. But I wonder if now that you, as you're going, now that girls are a little older, though, so getting back to the point about, you know, these sensitive issues, uh-huh. how they're processing these issues now that they're, oh, I guess, 16? Longer 14, 15, now they're 16, looking at 17 mm-hmm. and graduating high school next year and all that.
I think it was like...
They going to their senior years, or are they?
No. Gina is a sophomore, and Giovanna is a junior. They're one grade apart.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it's you know, I haven't, like, talked to them so intimately about, like, the themes of the film, actually. We talked a lot about it in the casting.
Right.
And then we sort of let it go, because then it just became about shooting the film, and they understood the context, and they were comfortable, and, you know, I wasn't, like, playing school psychologist.
No, it makes sense that they need to process it more naturally, not over-intellectualize mm-hmm. their performance during during that period, and then afterwards, sort of.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Gina was much more uncomfortable with the material than Giovanna was at first.
Right.
Giovanna I was, like, very straightforward with. I was like, look, it's not... a porn, you know, I'm not a pornographer. And she just kind of laughed, and she was like, I know, I get it, it's a movie, you know. And Gina was more sensitive. She was, like, in the summer between her 8th and 9th grade, which is, like,
yikes,
a vulnerable moment before high school. Very, I think, true. If it had been a year later, we would have been having a totally different conversation. But because she hadn't been sort of thrust into, you know, her freshman year of high school, it was, like, a lot to think about and a lot to sort of process. And, you know, I'm not sure she was, like, crazy about the character at first. She just, like, she thought what she was doing was, like, bizarre, and she didn't like it. And she, you know, she
was uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It took a long time to sort of get her to warm up to it.
And I was thinking about what it must be like now for a young woman, a very, you know, attractive, they're both very attractive, what it must be like socially. I mean, I can't imagine with the attention of guys or even, you know, even their age I'm talking about, and the explicitness of, you know, I just keep hearing about young guys their age who send text and sex photos of their genitals and all these things.
I think the film is, like, tame compared to the way people actually behave.
That's really, that's the fear, isn't it?
Like, because
it's like.
Sometimes I walk behind, like, groups of, like, you know, young high school students on the street, and the things that they talk about and the things that they say are so much more extreme than what I've put on the screen. But had I written those things, people would have thought it was, like, too absurd to believe, you know?
Right. Because a lot of the people that, I don't know how many, you know, a lot of people that are in that age, parents that are that age of high school and junior high school children, are not going to the movies that much.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't get a sense that they're going to the movies that much. And, you know.
No, it's a very blockbuster sort of, the attention is all in blockbusters.
Yeah, right. And bring it, you know, so if the family goes, it's going to be one type of movie, and then, you know, I think probably when they get the occasional night out, they're not going to. It's the exceptional folks that are going to go to an indie film. I mean, they exist, obviously, but, you know.
It's so, very different from when I was in high school.
Right.
I always went to the Angelica or to see things, you know, skip school to, like.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. So do you remember some of the early films that where you just had moments of where you were blown away or where you felt like this is something that I might think about doing? Did that happen as early as that? Or I assume you were just going because it was fun to do that.
Yeah, I never had it was years later. I'm going to make a movie.
No. Yeah. No, I
mean, I didn't
not.
Grow up with the camera in the house.
But were there?
Yeah.
What did your parents do?
My mom is a social worker, and she ran an outpatient mental health clinic in Cobble Hill called Baltic Street. She sort of treated the criminally insane for her entire career and managed a facility.
Really?
Uh-huh.
So, like, people that could be...
People who were institutionalized for
violent acts.
And that needed medication to be, you know, monitored and sane and on the streets. Mm-hmm. And my dad is an anthropologist and a professor.
Oh, where does he teach?
He teaches. He's just retired, actually. But he worked at Long Island University.
Uh-huh.
Just in downtown Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah, right on Flatbush, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So also not too far.
Both worked, you know, their entire careers in Brooklyn.
Yeah, that's something. You don't hear a lot of stories about that anymore. Like, you know, both my parents worked, but they worked in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Queens, actually, mm-hmm. you know, for most of my childhood, anyway. Yeah, so I was just trying to figure out when you figured out that filmmaking was going to be... Because before
much
you...
Much later.
Uh-huh. Had you gone, like, in college, were you, like, figuring, like, you were going to be doing something else completely?
No. I went to college, and I was...
I know you went to CalArts.
No. I went to CalArts for graduate school.
Right. Mm-hmm.
To study film, but my undergraduate degree was actually in theater.
Uh-huh.
And I went to, like, a big university in the Midwest called Indiana University.
Which one?
Indiana University in mm-hmm. Bloomington.
Sure.
And I studied theater, and I thought I wanted to, like, act. Mm-hmm. I was always involved with, like, theater and stuff when mm-hmm. I was, like, a kid. But when I got there, like, the department was so big, and it was, like, very overrun by graduate students. And I hadn't done anything after, like, 2 years, so I just decided that I was going to direct something. And that was sort of my first directing uh-huh. experience.
And you were there for another couple of years, obviously.
Yeah.
And so you did that.
Uh-huh. So and then I graduated, and I worked a little bit in theater, but I sort of realized that, I don't know, I didn't feel like it had a lot of opportunity attached to it. And mm-hmm. I was very tired of, like, kind of the black box. And mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I was specifically interested in sort of new play development. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just ran into, like, a lot of complications and frustration.
Right.
And I'd sort of always been interested in film, but I'd never really thought it was something I was, like, capable of doing because I didn't have any, like, technical skills. And mm-hmm. I didn't really know how you got, like, started directing a film. Like, I just didn't know where to begin.
So you then, but you've decided to mm-hmm. get your graduate degree mm-hmm. at CalArts.
Yes.
And then made the short, and then the feature.
Yeah, I made three shorts at CalArts, actually. Uh-huh. And then I made the feature 2 years after I graduated.
That's an amazing story. So, and one of those three got into Sundance.
Uh-huh.
It's quite a story.
How it happened.
So where do you go from here, then?
From here?
Yeah, like, what would be... Next,
I think I've started thinking about it. Next is like trickier.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine so.
It is, because you have a lot of, like, kind of optimism, you mm-hmm. know, in the first one, and sort of confidence, like, I just have to make it, you know, and a lot of determination and drive, and you don't really, like, necessarily think about the results. It's just about getting through the shoot.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
and making
and
it
you
happen.
Don't have a track record per se to
no,
that people are comparing you to and mm-mm. to holding you to, you know, now you actually have this very
to
public
measure me against myself.
Yeah.
It's like
which
not,
I guess is
it's a lot.
Double-edged sword.
It's a lot. And now I have this other sort of perspective where I've looked behind the curtain, you know, and I see what distribution is like and mm-hmm. like the actual industry. And it sort of, like, unfortunately filters into how you think about what's next.
Sure. Well, let's remind people. It felt like love. Well, besides, okay, so Gina Piersanti, you have
Giovanna
Salmeni.
Ronan Rubinstein.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Anthony Ryan. Jesse Cordasco, Case Prime.
It is a great film. It looks beautiful. It's like very little. I don't think it will remind you of anything you've seen, at least rarely. And it has a very unique look to it. And it definitely has a. Some scenes in there that will, you know, make you feel uncomfortable. And I think, but that's good. That's what we're supposed to be going to see films for, you know, to make you kind of provoke a little bit, but not in a, you know, just sort of some shock value or superficial way. But this is a real story. And so thank you for coming back on. And it'll be, again, premiering here in New York at the IFC Center. On March 21st, spend your first spring evening in the movies with and I'm sure Eliza, you'll be there.
I'll be there. The cast will be there, and we'll have some guest hosts.
Oh, really?
TBA.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All righty. Well, you know, if I can help in any way, let me know.
Thank you.
Happy to do so. All right. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
You're always welcome. So in your sophomore project, you'll come back? Yeah.
Hopefully it will be within the next couple of years.
I'll hold you to it. Last up in this fruitful show is a conversation with someone I had not met before, but it is the filmmaker of this new documentary called Teenage, and it is based on the book. It's based on a book. It's based on a very popular book called Teenage by John Savage. This is a collaboration of sorts, but the filmmaker I'm talking to, his name is Matt Wolf. The film is coming out, I believe, this Friday in New York, March 14th, and this is my conversation with filmmaker Matt Wolf.
We are teenagers, but we didn't always exist.
First, we were just children. And then all of a sudden, we were supposed to be adults. We went from rat-faced slum kids to fit and healthy soldiers, primed for war.
The news of war was intoxicating.
The old had sent us to die. And we hated them. American culture started to spread. They brought new music, dances, and films.
Whether they called us hooligans, flappers, jitterbugs, or subdebs, we knew who we were. Time had come to declare it.
Welcome to the podcast. Have you done many podcasts?
I have.
I suppose.
Well, you know what? I don't know if I've done a lot of podcasts.
He started with an enthusiastic lie, and then rescinded immediately.
Okay, I love podcasts, yeah. So I got a little overexcited.
Well, if you do, check out this one.
I think
you might like it. And a lot of probably people you like and
I've seen links to this podcast a lot.
Yeah, I think we might be online on Facebook.
Yeah, I think so.
And that might have actually, I might have actually even done taken care of that when you were one of 25 faces, faces.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
It might have been around the time. Because usually that, like when I'm trying to cultivate, you know, upcoming films and filmmakers and want to remember, I'll like go through the list every year when Scott publishes that. And then, you know, and it's one of the kind of sources I use to get people on my radar.
Yeah.
That and well-made films.
Oh, that's a good go.
Your film is called Teenage, and we're talking to Matt Wolf, who is the filmmaker, it's, let's just get out of the way. It's opening, I think, on the 14th in New York.
March 14th,
Friday, March 14th in New York, and then a couple of other cities, or hopefully many other cities. But we know LA the week later, right? And the 21st, and then et cetera, et cetera, and. It is, how would you describe it, I guess, as almost a social science type of look through archival footage at the phenomenon of being a teenager, right?
It's like a collage-style documentary about the invention of modern teenagers.
And it was, from what I've read and heard, it was inspired by the John Savage's book, right, Teenage.
Yeah, and John and I work closely together adapting his book.
Okay,
yeah.
Very good. It's an interesting case of where something like a film, a very obviously very different form of media than a book, can take a very different perspective on a subject. So what was that collaboration like? How did you arrive at working with this footage or archival footage?
Well, when I read John Savage's book, I was really impressed because I felt like, and I should say, John wrote the book England's Dreaming, which is kind of the definitive history of punk rock.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was reading his book, Teenage, I felt like he was coloring early 20th century history with a kind of punk perspective. And I thought, well, what if I tried to make a historical documentary that kind of departs from the PBS academic styles of history filmmaking and does something different, maybe in a kind of punk rock way. And, you know, it was about figuring out a different way to tell that sort of story. And at first I thought, okay, John will narrate the film, but it didn't work because he's British and, you know, for obvious reasons, he speaks with the authority of an expert.
The British voice just automatically by default sort of has that advantage.
Yeah, totally. You know? But it's a global story, and it's a story about a pretty emotionally turbulent time in people's life. And it just, it wasn't capturing that. So I thought, like, what if we just do quotes in the first person from actual teenagers that we've sourced through diaries and written testimonies? That's a big element in John's book. And we tried that, and it really worked, and it felt like a different way to tell a story. It's almost like a subjective history rather than a authoritative or definitive history.
Right, right, right. This particular evolution that you focus on is essentially a Western phenomenon, right?
Yeah, the teenager was more or less an American invention, but it was the product of decades of kind of fighting between different governments and societies about competing definitions over the role of youth. And that tension was clearest between America and Germany. In America, young people were developing power as consumers, and in Germany, they were being militarized and indoctrinated by the Nazi government. And, and that tension is really key to the film, but England played an important role too because it was really the gateway of American culture into Europe.
Consumerism and fascism, once again, tied at the hip.
Yeah.
You know, as you were starting to compile the footage, and what was kind of the order, I guess? You have well-known voices. These are recognizable voices, well-known actors who are supplying a voiceover narrative and telling stories. There's kind of the sort of factoid end side of it, and also personal, as you say, diary entries. How did you approach that?
John Savage and I made a rule that any story we told had to have a strong basis in actual archival footage. So that really helped us telescope into specific narratives, specific youth movements. And I knew that I also wanted to bring to life some individual characters. So I chose four characters whose I wanted to create portraits of within this bigger cultural history. So, you know, kind of archival footage research and script writing was happening in tandem, side by side. And John would source all these quotes from teenage diaries and written testimonies to provide kind of fodder for our script writing. And we would use that to, in a sense, create a narrative about the evolution of the idea of youth and the invention of the concept of the teenager.
Where were those? Where did you find those diaries, right? They were all four from those four stories.
They're from hundreds of books that over the 7 years that John spent writing the book Teenage, he sourced all of those books and those quotes. And I also collaborated with a German writer named Fred Grimm, who wrote a German history of youth entirely through kind of primary source quotes and images. So he was a perfect partner in terms of fleshing out the German voice.
What was your childhood or teenager years like?
Well, I was actually a really political teenager. I was really involved in gay activism when I was young, but I was also totally obsessed with independent and underground music and film. So I'd go to the record store and the movie theater by myself every weekend. And
just because you were kind of like a freak in that way?
Yeah, I was a bit of an outsider in that sense. But I also, but I wasn't kind of a loner. I was involved in a lot of things. I kind of did a lot of activism with other kids from around the Bay Area where I grew up.
Where was that?
I grew up in San Jose.
And so it wasn't necessarily typical. What were your parents? Were they encouraging of you, and had that history of activism in there?
My parents were different than me, but super encouraging of me at the same time. They were always really supportive of whatever I wanted to do.
And you were out from a fairly young age, is that where
when I was like 14.
Where did you get the nerve to do that?
Well, I came out in the mid to late 90s when it was kind of something was in the air. Ellen DeGeneres was coming out on TV. Matthew Shepard had been murdered. So it was kind of a cultural moment in which gay youth were getting a lot of attention because we represented kind of the next stage of gay rights.
Yeah. And so as you were saying, you were making trips into town to see films.
Yeah, I was going to the independent movie theater and the record store, and that was a big part of my identity, and so was politics. And I they felt pretty disconnected to me. And it was only since making this film that I found a kind of intersection in all of those interests.
Kind of a convergence.
Totally.
For you. So this film really is. And this is your first feature?
No, I made another feature called Wild Combination about an avant-garde cellist and disco producer named Arthur Russell. And that film came out
Arthur
in 2008.
Russell. Yeah, sure. His music, I believe, plays a prominent part in Ira Sachs' last film in the soundtrack.
Correct, yeah.
He's beautiful stuff. Beautiful singer. Yeah, great stuff. So, and that was one of the people that you stumbled across in your teenage years yourself?
No, I came across him a little later, but... You know, that process of kind of uncovering these forgotten kind of figures and artists, that's always been something that's been interesting to me ever since high school.
But during the excavation process of the film, of the story, I guess what I was trying to articulate earlier and not doing so great a job at it was, I was wondering, because you were using John Savage's book as a source, you already sort of had your story wrapped up before you began the production, or was there any element of the process of that which kind of opened your eyes to something, whether it's about kind of societal level issues or maybe internal ones, you know, because it in some level really had a personal, really like profound kind of effect as I was watching it. It was really, some of those stories were really profound and very emotional. And I was also, sidebar, watching some recent films by a filmmaker named Jay Rosenblatt. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know Jay's work.
Yeah,
he's also from the West Coast and tells similar types of I'll just say genre-wise, they're similar, but he also uses archival footage and does very personal, intensely personal stories out through voiceover. And they're really powerful in this way. I just wondered if there was during this process of making the film, if maybe you did discover something new.
Well, I think a kind of thread that was most significant to me that might have not come from the book as much as my own process was looking at teenage rebellion in a different way. I think teenage rebellion is often kind of disregarded as this emotional or hormonal rite of passage for young people. And
it isn't.
I think there's kind of some political substance to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that out of teenage rebellion comes a lot of cultural change. And I don't think I ever thought of it that way until looking at this history and making this film.
So would you say that is sort of a biological thing almost? There's sort of some connection you're drawing between a societal and a biological sort of...
I would say that it's cultural in the sense that, the young people are often disregarded with a lot of contempt from adults who feel that they're apathetic or apolitical or uncreative and less engaged than the previous generation. And I think that young people are doing interesting things and that time will tell what the impact of those things are. And yeah, I mean, I just think that it's easy for adults to look at teenagers' kind of outbursts as being meaningless because they're just considered hormonal or biological, but that there's a real substance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say it's what they're doing is actually reimagining the future.
Mm-hmm. Years himself. But it sounds like on your end, in terms of your folks, that you were given a certain amount of freedom.
Yeah, I definitely got a lot of freedom, and I think it empowered me to do creative and political things.
Yeah. Well, what kind of things are you currently engaged in outside of filmmaking? Are you writing, or do you have other...
Yeah, I mean, my work is a big part of my life, and it involves a lot of collaborations kind of outside of film. But, you know, I'm as interested in music and visual arts and literature as I am in film. So I find myself absorbed in a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's I'm a big kind of culture hound myself.
Now, where did Teenage premiere?
Teenage premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival last year.
It was at Tribeca. Okay, and did you take it to a bunch of festivals?
It's been at festivals around the world, and it's almost been a year since it premiered, and it's coming out March 14th. So almost a month to a year before it's like 1 month before a year after the premiere.
What have the Q&As been like? What do people tend to kind of respond to the most in the film?
They're good. I mean, I think there's people come to the film with expectations because we were all teenagers. We all lived through that experience. And I think they think, well, what about this or what about that? Or I think people desire more information about youth culture after the war, whereas this film kind of ends with the invention of the teenager. We say it's a story that ends with the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I was under the impression that it sort of started there.
Yeah. No, it actually ends there. So that I think the film kind of... you know, challenges expectations in that way. But it's been really satisfying to see young people and their reactions, because they've responded in a really powerful way to the film.
So have a lot of teenagers had the opportunity and then approached you? Or have
I've heard from a lot of teenagers, both teenagers who have seen the film or who are trying to see the film. And that's exciting to me. I think they're kind of my dream audience for the film.
Sure. Well, so what steps are you taking, if any, in terms of making the film available to the two teenagers? I can guess maybe that this would be a really assume that this would be a really natural film for institutional distribution.
I mean, we're not there yet because we're just working on the theatrical release, but I have been publishing an online youth culture blog for the past 3 years, and have kind of social media components to that too, so there's kind of a pretty big following of people who've been just like involved with the project through that, and our hope is to continue our conversation with them so that they can see the film when it's available on iTunes and Amazon and all those digital outlets. And the website is teenagefilm.com.
Oh, okay. That's where that...
That's where that blog and all the details are about where the film's playing.
Okay, because, yeah, this would be a lost... A shame. It would be quite a lost opportunity for teenagers not to see the film and to be able to sort of engage.
Yeah, I really want to reach them, and we're trying our hardest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, this is obviously... it must be a really good anecdote, is this, that the... your connection to Jason Schwartzman and how he signed on as executive producer.
Yeah, Jason was a fan of my first film, Wild Combination, and we were kind of paired up to make a commercial together a few years ago, and he later came to me saying that he was interested in producing films and wanted to support what I was doing, and he happened to be a fan of John Savage, so this felt like a good project for us to collaborate on.
Oh, I see. So it was as simple as that. Is he had, I don't know, did he have any... more direct input to the film, or was it more just
he's been like kind of just a supportive person involved with the project who's helped us kind of approach key partners and also get the word out about the film.
Yeah, I just saw two nights ago, maybe I saw the Grand Budapest
Hotel. Cool, I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I bet you're gonna enjoy it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and he's in it briefly, but enough so you can enjoy it.
That's great.
Yeah. It's a very entertaining film. Were there other films that inspired you? I mentioned Jay Rosenblatt. I don't know if that was somebody who was on your radar, but
I was also really inspired by Adam Curtis's essay films. He's a British filmmaker who makes really amazing, archivally dense essay films. Uh-huh. And then in terms of the recreation I filmed, I was inspired by Woody Allen's film Zelig, because that mixed 1920s recreations with stage scenes that mixed very seamlessly, that had Woody Allen and Mia Farrow kind of acting as if they were in a 1920s newsreel.
When did you see that?
What?
When did you see that film?
A DP recommended I look at it when I was talking about shooting these styles of recreations, and it really inspired me.
Oh, so you hadn't seen Zelig before?
No, I had never seen it until I started developing this project.
It kind of blew you away?
Yeah, totally.
it's I guess, considered one of his more minor works in a way, but it's
I don't think so.
A lot of people... No, and I don't mean that in terms of... I mean, think it just in terms of popular, you know, awareness of that film and, you know, in the... pop culture, it's not as, you know, it's not, let's say, usually mentioned in the same breath as an Annie Hall or even maybe, you know, Crimes and Misdemeanors or Hannah and Her Sisters and all. But interesting connection there, but it's very true. So the film is going to be opening here in New York City, and also, is it opening any other cities on the 14th? Or is it
not on the 14th, but it's playing in a bunch of cities, like 10 other cities in the weeks that follow. So at our website, teenagefilm.com, there's a section that has all the play dates that's being updated.
We'll put that on the show notes and make sure that a lot of people get to see that. Then we already mentioned a week later in L.A., right? So
yeah.
And I assume you're going to be showing up and doing...
I'll be doing Q&A's at the Sunshine Theater in New York, and I'll be around.
That'll be great. Hopefully, we'll reach some teenagers between now and next Friday.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
And and where are you currently living, in Brooklyn?
I live in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Yeah. Where about?
I live in Williamsburg.
Oh, very good. Okay. Thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for talking to me.
Sure. I hope I really hope that a lot of people see the film.
Thank you.
And it was really terrific. And it was like one of these films that it kind of stayed with me for a day or two.
That's great.
You know,
great,
I don't know if
hear.
You get that reaction much, but it has that. It kind of creeps into your system a little bit, and
that's what I'm going for.
Achieved. Matt Wolf, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people try to shape the future. but it's the young ones who live in it. And we are the ones who will fight for it. Those who get the youth get the future.
I just want to thank everybody, by the way, at CineReach and at Oscilloscope for their help with making the number of these interviews possible. So if those felt a little bit shorter than normal, don't worry. The next couple of, we've got a couple of episodes coming up, not only episode 200, but shortly after that, I'm going to have a conversation up with a documentary filmmaker named Liz Garbus. I'm sure you've heard of her if you know documentaries, and she gave me quite a bit of time, so I'm looking forward to airing that for you. Just stay tuned. You know, the best way, of course, to get the show is to subscribe on iTunes. You just go to iTunes and look up Film Wax or Film Wax Radio. It'll come right up, and just do that, please. And if you're doing that, it takes only a moment longer to just click on a star. Give me a star rating. Be generous. Be thoughtful. Be kind. And if you want to leave a comment, there's an option for that, too. If you have constructive comments, you can, you know, again, post them on Facebook, on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/filmwaxradio. I have a Filmwax page, too, but this one's Filmwax Radio. And feel free to, yeah, leave me a comment or interact. I'll get back to you. You know, there was something else I wanted to share. A friend of mine, a young man named Ethan Mermelstein, started a really entertaining podcast. It's quite different than this podcast, but I really enjoyed it. I listened to his first two episodes ever. It's called Emotionally Reckless. You can find it also on iTunes and subscribe to Ethan's podcast. It's all about inner exploration, but it's done with a great amount of humor. Sort of what's also kind of refreshing is it lacks irony. It's earnest, but it's kind of edgy, too. So it's kind of like he kind of finds this interesting space there that he straddles, talking all about him. And he brings people on, at least in the first two episodes, and basically talks about what they think of him. So enough about me, what do you think about me? Should have been the name of the show. But again, I'm not sure what will happen in future episodes, but I recommend it. And I'm just flipping through my iPhone podcasts here. A few others here that I do listen to. NPR has a show called Snap Judgment. I enjoy that. I enjoy a lot of these great stories, like Unfictional is another that I listen to. Of course, The Moth I check into. Freakonomics Radio I check into. Film Spotting. And I listen to Mark Maron, of course, WTF Radio Lab. You know, it's hard to keep up with a bunch of them, but I do my best. I listen to a lot of stuff, and it gives me all sorts of ideas, and it makes me feel bad because I don't have enough sponsors. What I said that. I did. I said that. Yeah. Well, you know, you're my partners right now, folks. If you're listening, you're my partner, so please, again, do reach out. Come to the live podcast. I'm doing it, again, on April 12th at Videology, if you're in or around New York. And then, but I'm going to be doing another one, I believe. It's not confirmed, but I might be doing one also at the Northside Festival a little later in the spring. I think this is going to become like a regular thing. I would love to do a handful of these every year to meet folks and to also, you know, just create a buzz about what I'm doing, get the word out. So in the meantime, though, you are my ambassador, so I appreciate it. I know you're listening. I can tell. And I really do, really, really, really do. I'm honored that people are listening and they may be interested in the show. And that's me being earnest and lacking irony. So, you know, I wanted to talk about other things and films that are going on, but I'm kind of running out of time. It's been a very long, long couple of podcasts here. But I do want to remind people, do go check out these films. They're very worthwhile, and I have seen a few of the films from new directors, and they're spectacular. So there's a lot of great films that are coming up. If you didn't make it to South by Southwest or Sundance, right now is a good time to be in New York. So thank you, guys. I don't know. We may leak who the guest is in a few days, so check it out. But it's not like it's a life-changing event here, but this is a spectacular 200 show coming up. I have to say I'm very happy about it. And just to reach the number is a big deal. Let's face it, it's quite a benchmark, right? 200 episodes. Okay, folks, this is your friend Adam Shartoff, host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time.
Shout, shout, let it all out. These are the things
things I can do without. Come on, talking to you. Come on, in violent time. You shouldn't have to sell your soul.